Welcome to another episode of the Fair Chase podcast. Appreciate you guys coming in. I got Joe here, but prior to jumping into some things around bear scouting, I have a few housekeeping items to take care of. So first things first, we're really excited, and I just want to tell everybody about this this sweepstakes that we're doing with Worldwide Trophy Adventures, or WTA. If you followed us at all over the past couple months, you've seen I went on a pretty sweet moose hunt. We filmed it, got a bunch of cool media out of it, and shot a really nice Canadian moose. So what they're doing is actually giving away one of those hunts. So this is kind of like a once-in-a-lifetime trophy-producing area in British Columbia. It's a fly-in hunt. They'll get bulls, you know, hitting that 60-inch mark, which is a big Canadian moose. It's a one-to-one guided hunt, so it's like you and a guide, which is nice. So you also, when you apply, you get some bonus bucks with every sweepstakes purchase, so you have discounts for future things you want to do with them. So enter between now and May 13, and you basically go, we'll put a link in the description notes, and it's on our YouTube or our LinkedIn Instagram page as well. And so you can go there, you pay a couple, you pay like 30 some bucks, and you can enter to win this $36,000 hunt. So I'm kind of passionate about it because I had such a good time. I want to share it with everybody else and make sure you have a chance to win it as well. So that's item number one. Number two, we're going to start doing the format of our podcast a little different. So this podcast will start with me and Joe talking just some bear scouting stuff, e-scouting specifically. And then you will hear an interview I did with Fargon, which is a media company. Check that out. Just stay tuned. Let us know what you think of the new format. We're kind of excited for it. So, Joe, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Doing well. This is try number two for us for this. I felt like my ad read about the sweepstakes went a lot better the first time. But you know, what can you do? We just move on.
Dude, I feel like your bad luck with coyote hunting and my bad luck with audio and recording is very similar.
I would rather have bad luck with audio than coyote hunting, I'll just say, but you know, whatever. So, you know, it's March right now, which means, you know, Joe, you and I have been texting a bit about bear hunting and ideas for bear hunts for this year and next year. And we just like to talk about bears. So I figured we'd take a little time just to talk through. A lot of our listeners have never gone on a bear hunt or going on one of the first time, or maybe just want to get better at it. And so I figured we'd take a few minutes just to talk about how we kind of get ready to hunt bears in new areas.
Yeah, so the last, I don't know, it's probably five or six springs now. Got into hunting bears in the springtime, primarily Montana. We did an Alaskan hunt last year. Last year I did some in Idaho and Wyoming as well. We've kind of put together like a pseudo formula of what is good bear habitat, successful areas for us, and what we were kind of spinning our wheels with. And this doesn't like ring true for everything. Obviously, you kind of find them anywhere. There's pockets of them anywhere and everywhere, especially across the West. But
they're bears. They will go everywhere.
Yeah, they'll do their thing. And if they stash some carcasses and stuff the year previous or the fall previous, they might end up in a different spot. If it's a particularly heavy snow year, which it is not this year, that might determine a little bit where they're at from a water source and a green up perspective. But the biggest things that we started to kind of notice year in, year out is we're finding bears in the same places year after year. And it doesn't mean like the exact same geographical place, but if you look at it on a map, like all these spots have very similar characteristics to them. And the biggest one that I've noticed that almost unanimously across the board with every bear that I've seen in the spring is he's within some close proximity to flowing water, whether that's a river that's constantly flowing year in and year out, or it's a heavy area of snow melt that's creating a rushing creek in the bottom that could be dry in the fall, and kind of everything in between. Like even one that we killed last June in Wyoming had kind of like this boggy, mosquito-y, nasty pond to it, but there always seems like they're just close to water. Yeah. When I say close to water, I don't mean they're in 200 yards of it, but it might be within a drainage or two of a big water source kind of thing. So that's been my focus now, is like, you can look at the south facing exposures. You can look at areas that have, like, avalanche chutes are great. You can look at areas,
like, steep drainages. They like those canyons. Yeah.
Steep drainages that are going to have a little bit more water flowing down them when that snow starts melting, green up a little bit faster kind of thing. Sun exposure, south and east facing slopes, things like that. But I've spent a lot of time just marking south and east facing slopes and good looking country to get there and be like, okay, this is still brown and crispy. There ain't no green here. And the closer that you are to that water source, it seems like that greens up faster, because consequently it takes more water to create flowing water. The more water, the more green up, generally speaking. So you're going to see your grass is coming up a little bit sooner or more abundantly. You'll see the wild onions and the shoots and the glacier lilies and the flowers that you see a little bit later in the year that the bears like to eat. So that's been kind of my primary, like, focus, is just being close to water. And then the other part of it is, like, deciding what tactic you want to kind of use on this hunt. If you're going to go way up into the Northwest and it's a lot of, like, logging road country, you're looking for recent clear cuts. You're looking for burns. You're looking for pinches and canyons where you can shoot from the road or from that logging trail across canyon and not have it be 1,500 yards kind of thing. Yeah. If you're looking at spot and stock opportunities, the biggest thing that I've started to look for is continuous ridges that we can run and be within striking distance of the opposite base.
That's how we got you on that bear in Montana.
That is the perfect example. It was a series of finger ridges coming off of this one main ridge, and you could work these finger ridges for a mile and a half and 2 miles without exerting a lot of energy, but you're still within 700-800 yards of the opposite face, and there's flowing water in the bottom, broken country. There's a lot of green up in there. It was just good. Cliffy stuff, too. If you can find areas where you have the south facing exposure that's close to that rock and there's, like, that big cliffy section in the bottom part of the canyon, it seems like that's always a pretty good spot too.
When we first went a couple of years ago, we, you know, it took days for us to get into bears. I mean, we covered a lot of ground for a while. And, you know, most of the time what we were doing was looking for that green up edge, you know, like right where it's the brightest color green stuff. And what we had a hard time was with, we had a hard time with finding that green up. There was one particularly devastating hike where we got way into a spot that we thought would be sweet if it didn't have snow. And so we're working our way up, and I remember we get up over to this, you know, this real big meadow, and it's like waist deep snow. It's like, we're not even close. One thing that I feel like is pretty important is finding that right elevation, depending on time of year. You know, like beginning of the spring, I mean, you're a little lower as things get warm. You know, that green up gets higher and higher up the mountain. So I feel like beginning of the spring, you're about 5,000 generally and below, depending on where you are and depending on presence of water and things like that. And then later in the spring, sometimes they'll either push up or, you know, based on what you saw last year, you saw them kind of down as well.
OnX is the title sponsor of our podcast here at the Fair Chase, and it's a must-have app for all of us who love to explore the outdoors. Whether you're hunting or hiking or fly fishing, OnX gives you detailed, accurate maps right at your fingertips. With property boundaries, topographical features, and trail data, you'll always know where you are and where you're headed. You'll also likely be able to figure out where that big buck is headed to. Plus, their offline maps mean you're covered even in the most remote locations. OnX is the ultimate tool for outdoor navigation, making every adventure safer and more enjoyable. Download OnX today and explore with confidence.
That's initially kind of what I thought too, is that, like, there's an elevation that these bears are congregating at depending on the time of the year. And the more that I've done this, the more I realize how I think that's not, it's not a rule. And it's less of even a guideline than I initially thought. Sometimes early in the season, you'll find them up very high yet, especially if there's, like, some cliffy, denny looking stuff up high. And it can be one 50 yard circle that got burned off, and there's some shoots coming up in that thing, and there's snow all the way around it. That's a magnet, right?
Yeah.
But what we ran into this is 2 years ago, we're talking about this hunt in Montana. We cruised into this area in region two, and all the private ground, all the bottom country, like literally yards had grass in it. The road edges had grass in it. We gained like 1,200-1,300 feet just driving, and then another 1,000 kind of getting up to our glassing point. And I'm looking at this hill that's historically, like, I see a bear on this hill usually. And I look back 1.5-2 miles down onto the private from that man on the road, and there's a bear 60 yards from this guy's shed.
I forgot about this.
Yeah, so we did see a bear the first day, but it was literally 60 yards from this guy's shed. And super low elevation. Now, that same situation, similar weather, a couple years previous, we saw a bear up in the top, like the very tippy top of that mountain, flipping rocks, looking for grubs.
Yeah.
And it was warmer, actually, the year that we saw him low. So it's kind of a toss-up. I think there's no hard and fast rule to it. It's not, there's not a science to it, but there's like things that I look for every year where I get a really good gut feeling. Like as soon as we set up on that one, the bear that I missed that night, as soon as we got on that ridge, I'm just like, here we go. This is the one.
Yep.
And I've had that feeling a few other times. And it's like, usually if you kind of get that gut feeling, you've seen it enough, no different than if you're in a tree stand in November and you feel that pressure drop, like, you know, something's going to happen.
Yep.
I get that same feeling with spring bears when I kind of get in that right environment and maybe it just started sprinkling a little bit and you know it's going to clear up. You're like, something's going to happen here tonight.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean. That's a lovely feeling. And definitely when we walked up on that ridge line that we walked, it's like looking across, it's like, man, this, if it's going to happen, we have, this is the spot. Like you pointed out though, it's really hard to come up with like, here are the three, you know, rules you follow to find a bear, because of just like bears are not deer. Bears like kind of have personality. They do kind of random stuff. It's not like you see like a deer trail where they're running it, you know, regularly. Bears are just, they'll be all over the place doing kind of whatever they want just because they're just their own animal. They do their own thing.
There's like two times a year where I feel like a spring bear is predictable. And even at that, that's kind of a loose phrase, right? So if you go really early, like let's say it's a normal year and you have good snowpack and you go on April 15 in Montana and you find a open hillside, it might not even be green yet from 1,000 yards across. It doesn't appear green. There might be little shoots and stuff popping up in there, but if there's an open hillside and it's warm enough that he's out of his den, pretty good chance he's going to be on that and pretty good chance he's going to be repeatable until he finds a better food source. So really early in the season, might be hard to find, might be less bears out. But if you can find that spot that they're on, it's kind of like a food plot for deer that's unpressured. Like he's going to be there every night. Yep. Now, the opposite's true at the end of the season. So I spent some time last year in June in Wyoming and Idaho and Montana, actually, hunting bears kind of in that corner around the park. At that point, everything's green. The flowers are up. There's green inside of the timber. There's green in the shade. Like everything's green. So now you can't target this specific type of forage for them. But the calves were dropping. So fawn, mule deer, calf elk, calf moose, big herds. Like it's springtime. Everything's out in the sun, enjoying it. And within like 15, 20 minutes of seeing a group of elk come out onto a hillside, we'd either see a black bear or a grizzly bear almost without exception for those 3 days that we were hunting in there.
Yeah.
So if you can find the elk late, then you can find the calving grounds late and the season in that specific area runs into that June month. We had a lot of fun with that last year.
You saw a lot of bears, a lot of bears.
Yeah. We saw more bears in that 3 days of hunting than we did that previous May in a week.
Yeah.
But it was just because we were on the elk.
Quick shout out to another amazing sponsor of ours, Kafaru International. If you're like us and love hunting in some of the toughest places, you know how crucial having the right gear is. Kafaru makes some of the toughest, most reliable backpacks and tents out there, and it's all made right here in America. Whether you're hunting in the backcountry or headed to your favorite deer stand, Kafaru has you covered. Keep your eyes out this year, especially as they're launching a ton of amazing new products like the new Arc frame that just came out. So next time you gear up for an adventure, make sure to check out Kafaru International.
Yeah. No, you got to find food. And like, you know, just for those of you who are maybe looking to do something like in Alaska off of like a boat base, like we did, I mean, same types of ideas apply. It's like, where is the food, you know? And so like, if you're out there and you're doing this, you're looking for either they're looking for mussels on the beach, probably a little bit later, or they're just doing the same hillside thing. So it's these types of ideas do carry kind of throughout tons of different types of bears or where they live. But again, it's like where you're at. It's kind of site specific to figure out exactly where they're going.
Yeah, there's lots of little nuances and like things that kind of come into play with where you're hunting. If you're hunting close to cattle, if you're hunting close to like coastal bears, way different situation, but similar. Yeah. People, just different elements that go into it. So
grass flats, you know, things like yeah. that. Yep.
Grass flats, mussels, and like where we found them in Alaska, they just flat were not on the beach.
They were just not us.
Yeah, it was a rough hunt. But then once we kind of came to grips with that, we're like, okay, this side of the coast, this side of the mountain is way deep in snow. We have very small areas that are actually truly burned off. Then we really started turning up bears a lot quickly, a lot more quickly. But it wasn't a roll up on the beach and like storming the beaches in Normandy like we thought it would be with bears everywhere, and we're passing 300 pounders, we're looking for a big one kind of thing.
Which is the conversation we had going in. It's like, well, what type of bear are we going to go after? It's like, at the end, it's like any legal bear.
Yeah, know? A bear with a pulse is what we were after after day three. So, yeah, it's everything is timing with them. Everything is situational. I feel like I overcomplicate it from a scouting perspective to a point, but yeah. It's hard not to. Once you just spend more time in different country, you get a lot more of a rhythm of like, this looks good or this
doesn't.
It's
a gut thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a deeper knowledge thing that's like beyond what you read. You know, it's just like experiential, I guess. Wanted to make sure we took some time to talk about it. We do get some questions about it fairly often. And actually, coming up this spring, the bear hunt we're talking about in Alaska goes live on Vortex Optics channel. So there'll be a lot of information for that to come, but you'll be able to at least see some of the things Jared and I dealt with there specifically. You know, we did get into bears. It was tough though. It took a few days and a few storms and some huge waves and a lot of fish, and you know, we got into it.
It was a super fun trip, but I definitely have a different idea of how to do it. For the next, yeah. I definitely want to do some more coastal stuff.
I would do that again. I would like to make that kind of a semi-regular thing, like every couple of years go, because you come back with fish. And I mean, I think in a normal year, we would have done a lot better with the number of bears we took out of there. So, I mean, that was a sweet hunt. That was a lot of fun.
It's just something fun to do in the spring.
Yeah, I mean, and like some people say, you know, like, well, when you're out there, you can kind of scout for elk. And I guess you kind of can, but I feel like things are way different in the fall than they are at that time of year. So at least you get a sense of like the country, but to get really hard evidence of like where the elk are going to be, I feel like it's not the most productive. I don't know if you've seen anything different, Joe.
The biggest thing it is for me is like, yeah, I do turn up some good elk country, like evidence of rut, trees shredded. Yeah. Old wallows, things like that. But my first hunt in Montana leading up to elk hunting out there was for bear. So if anything is, if you're an Eastern hunter going out west and you look at your total exposure of how many days you spend in the mountains, going bear hunting might not make you a better elk hunter, but it'll make you better like woodsman. It'll make you better just like, you know how to move in that country so much better, because there's big moves that happen with bear hunting. And if you have to make a big move on your first elk hunt, like it's taxing, it takes time, it takes energy, it eats out of your elk hunt. So if you learn how to kind of traverse that country during bear season, your elk hunting is probably better.
Yeah, there are a lot of the same ideas, but like you said, like when you're out there, it just feels different. Like everything's big, and it's just, you have to have a different mindset, totally right. Different. Yeah.
So for a lot of people that are listening from the east going out west, like you can even view a bear hunt as just like, I'm going to get my stride in the mountain kind of thing, so that when I get a $1,200 elk tag and I take that vacation time, take 10 days off of it, like you actually have boots on the ground and have some familiarity with that type of hunting before you get into it.
Yeah. Well, and bear tags are a lot cheaper than for the most part, or in some states than elk tags are. So it's like kind of like a lower cost. You get the same adventure. There's less people out there. There's a lot of really cool things about bear hunting. Bear hunting is just like a classic American activity. It's like, that's history. So
it's one of my, like, it's probably the one this year is a little bit different just because the year is starting so chaotically busy. I usually spend a lot more time thinking about bears than I have this year.
Yep.
And it'll probably be a shorter bear run for me this year than what it normally would. But it's something that I look forward to fondly every single day.
Same. Yeah, we, you know, this, I feel the same way. Like, this year is going to be slower than I would have liked, but, you know, for a good reason. We're working on a lot of cool things here at the Fair Chase. So, I wanted, like I said, just take some time to go through it and remind everybody, hey, we've got a bear film coming out. So keep your eyes peeled for that. If you have any questions about bear hunting or need anything, just feel free to shoot us a message. We love to share what we are learning. And thanks again for the time.
This episode is also brought to you by 2O Gear, innovators in technical hunting clothing. 2O is a newer company. It's based right here in Michigan. And whether you're hunting elk in the mountains or chasing antelope in the plains or traipsing through swamps after that ruddy buck, 2O has you covered with premium jackets and pants, merino wool layers, everything you could possibly need to stay comfortable in the woods. Their products are engineered for functionality and durability, ensuring you stay protected in any conditions. Plus, their camo is really effective. We're big fans. So don't take our word for it, though. Go to 2ogear.com and check it out.
All right. We are here. Nolan and I and Nolan. Nolan, how are you?
Doing great, James. Doing great, man. So, yeah, can't complain. Beautiful day out here in British Columbia. So how are you doing?
I'm doing well. For everybody, Nolan is kind of a, would you say you're the founder of Far Gone or?
Not at all, actually. Nick's the guy that founded it. Yeah. So, or I guess a little backstory about Far Gone. Nick's the guy that founded it. He founded it in 2017 off of a goat hunt. And then kind of from there, I partnered with him maybe like a year or two ago, kind of as like a co-owner, and I do all the producing stuff and he does more of the directing stuff. So that's kind of how our team works out here. So
that's sweet.
Yeah, well, Nick's the guy that founded it.
Okay. Fair. But for our purposes, you founded, Far Gone, you know, the founder of Far Gone, Nolan, and no, I appreciate you being on. We were just talking prior to recording. You're in British Columbia. What part are you in? Are you in?
Yeah. So we're based out of Chilliwack, BC, within an hour's drive of anything good, or at the same time, got everything good in our backyard here too. So
how do you spell that?
Chilliwack. Oh my gosh. I got to Google this here.
Chilliwack. Got it. Chilliwack.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you're south. Okay. I see. We were talking on the way in about how I had, and we've talked about this in the podcast a little bit, driven from Michigan to British Columbia, but we hopped over in Portal, North Dakota, and we kind of went through Banff, or did we go? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we went through Banff, and was it Jasper, Banff, and then we drove back up kind of near Smithers, so kind of north of you, but
yeah,
like I said this I think in another podcast, but I had never seen so many bears on the side of the road as I saw in British Columbia. I think we saw 7 on the way out in a 2-hour stretch and 7 on the way back, actually. Just bears eating grass right next to the pavement.
Oh, I tell you, it's pretty awesome for sure. Like the black bear thing is, they're abundant. I get them on my, I live in a townhouse complex, like that backs up into the forest, and I get them on my doorstep kind of all throughout the year, and could send you tons of videos of just taking the dog out for a late night piss and here's this black bear sitting on the doormat. So
that warms my heart. That's all I want. That's what I want. I want to be able to walk outside and have just a black bear walking around. That just makes me so happy to know that exists.
Yeah, it is true. It is true. So yeah, we love them, man. It's it makes you feel like you're out there, but at the same time, you're 5 minutes from the pizza shop and all that different
right.
stuff too.
Well, that's why the bears are around. That's good.
Yeah, exactly.
Garbage.
That's a great point, actually. It's a great point. So yeah, no, definitely tons of bears. And to be honest, I love hearing from people that, I don't know, got a lot of buddies in Florida and in different spots like this, and just hearing like the fascination around bears. And I guess just growing up in British Columbia, just they're just like a normal part of life, right? Yeah. Like you go mountain biking or whatever, and you're always running into them. Or like I said, you get them on your doorstep. So it's cool to hear the fascination. I feel like I lose that a little bit just being around them so much. So
we're getting them back here in Michigan. The number is growing. I forgot how many we have right now. Not a ton. We have enough for seasons and stuff. And, you know, if you go to the right spots in the UP, you can pretty much draw every year, but it's nothing like where you're at. I will say though, you're right about like good garbage. Like 2 years ago, I was in Montana hunting. We were a little early, having a hard time getting into bears. And my plan, I never really totally implemented this plan because we ended up shooting one that day, but was to go hunt the back or kind of near a where I thought bears would be going down into a dump and try to like ambush them going from public land into this private dump area. Never actually tried it out, but it felt like a good plan.
It sounds like a great plan, but at the same time, I don't know how much legitimacy there is to like the garbage bear thing.
Yeah.
But like, at least for all of us, like, yeah, I feel like there is some gimmies, like exactly what you're saying, close to the dump for all these different spots or even kind of behind the house here too. But for us, it's all about like the high alpine bears.
Yeah.
Like the berry bears are the ones that we want to like go and pursue. And I don't know how much legitimacy there is to like maybe a bear that's been feeding on berries for 6 months as opposed to a bear that's been eating on rotten salmon down by the river.
Yeah, they're going to taste a little different.
Definitely. So
the high country bears are way more fun. I mean, to glass them, you know, cross a valley, put a stalk on them, do that whole thing is fun as it gets.
Oh, it's such a great time. So it's just such a great time. So we have this one zone that we always refer to as kind of like our honey hole. And it's like, you walk in there, you get in there in the morning, it's just this high alpine zone and just covered in blueberries, and you kind of just take your pick, which is always a lot of fun. And we've had a couple legendary days there where it's like, hey, you have a black bear and you have a buck in your backpack and you're packing out by 10 o'clock and you got there at 6 a.m. So
it's a good day.
It's a good day for sure.
So far gone. For everybody who's maybe doesn't know, what do you guys do?
Yeah, so we're a media production house that specializes in hunting and fishing. So I would say 90% hunting, 10% fishing.
Okay, that's a good mix. I'll go up to 20% fishing, but you know that's like the division of my love, like 100% for the outdoors. Like, you know, I'll go 80% hunting, and then I'll have like a 20% chunk of my love for outdoors dedicated to the. Maybe it's a little higher, but it's right in that range.
Oh, 100%. You got to keep your percentages in check too, right?
Yeah, so, right.
We've been doing a good job of, I would say the fishing percentage is definitely beginning to climb and climb and climb, just mostly out of, over the last little bit, both Nick and I started to get into fishing, but growing up, like we weren't much fishermen or anything like that. So I think it was just kind of more, you obviously are going to film what your interests are in. But then as you start getting more and more into it, the fishing side's beginning to come up. And I tell you, man, like the fishing bug has started to catch me a little bit. As soon as you're catching like a wild salmon or something out of the river, and for us too, it's 3 minutes, 4 minutes from my house, and just typically would go out every morning during the salmon run, kind of get it for an hour and a half and be back at the office for 8:30. And you have a fresh caught wild salmon that you can chuck on your dinner table that night. It's
sweet.
That side's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's hard to beat. Yeah, I've been, I grew up fishing like spinner reels and bass, like largemouth bass.
Cool.
It's just what I did.
Yeah.
You know, occasional crappie stuff too. But I live on a river now, so I've been getting into like smallies. And I really, this year, I really, really badly want to get into fly fishing. Something I've never, no one's ever taught me, didn't know anybody. So I got Joe that's going to teach me, and I got a few other buddies that go out. So that's kind of going to be my next thing, I think.
Oh, heck yeah, dude. You got to tell me, what's the fascination with bass? I filmed a fishing TV show called Instill the Catch. That's been just on whatever different networks and stuff. And heavily about it was around like the Izumi family, which is like a big bass family.
Yeah.
And I always had a hard time being like, okay, like I just, everything that we want to get, like, I want to eat.
Yeah,
and the thing with bass is I'm like, are people really eating bass? Like, what's like, then there's such a huge market around the bass stuff. Like, I'd love to hear a little bit about that. Sell me on it.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm not going to give you the, like, the, probably the greatest, like, you know, those guys down south that are like into those football size looking bass, you know, Michigan's a little different, but, and you can eat them. And I have eaten a ton of bass and they're not like the greatest, but I've eaten a lot of them, but I like them because it's like, you hunt them out. Like you're, I don't know. It's just like, there were a bunch of them. They fight really hard. It's fun to find. You can like find them in small ponds. So, you know, especially when I was like, just got my license in high school, I fished all summer just because it was like, I can go outside. I can find a, you know, this, you know, the secret spot that no one knows about. Yeah. It's this weird pond behind the school or something like that, that usually holds some bass. And so it was just kind of like, we did a lot of that. Jared and I, especially, did a ton of bass fishing. But I don't know. I guess that's really, they fight a lot. They're fun. They can go
get behind that.
Get them. They, you can catch them deep or shallow or with tons of things, and they're just everywhere. So I don't know. That's just what I was taught to, you know.
It's kind of like the hunting perspective though, too. Like you're presenting it as like a bit of a challenge and stuff like that, which I feel like is something that I haven't really been presented before. So I could get behind that for sure.
I liked it, you know, and that's why I say I see that similar type of thing with like fly fishing, but like to an like an elevated, you know, just even more. So my wife and my daughter and I are headed back. We're going to head to Jasper and Banff this, this summer, I guess you could say, like early summer. So I want to start fly fishing so I can head out there and see what I can come up with, but I got like limited time to figure that out. So.
Oh no, just get whatever you need. Just chuck it on in there.
I saw you guys fly fish.
Yeah, I love it, man. I absolutely love it. I'm the biggest rook at it, hands down. I'm not going to try to tell you that I'm some pro, but I wouldn't say it's in the wrist. I feel like it's more in the forearm. At least that's what's been described to me. It's like keeping that forearm kind of straight. And there might be some fly people that listen to this and are like, hey, absolutely not. But that's what works for me. So,
right.
Yeah.
But you're fine because, you know, people that listen to this, if they like, if you're like an archery snob and you watch some of our videos, you're going to hate it because we're punching the trigger on occasion. There's no like surprise release or anything like that, you know? So any snobs probably have weeded themselves out of listening to this podcast because we're, you know, not always. I was just watching my, pulling some clips from my moose hunt I was telling you about in British Columbia.
Oh yeah.
And he's got a close up of me shooting and, I think on the, it must've been the second shot. You should see my finger. Like it's not a squeeze. It's just like a pop. Yeah. I'm just sending it, you know? So I laugh every time.
It's the,
like,
oh crap. This is my opportunity. I just gotta get it right now.
You know, it was shot number two on a bull. So, you know, it's all hell breaks loose and you're kind of blackout at that point. But
I love it.
So you guys, you said you were founded when on a goat hunt. Like what does that mean?
So the story goes is that Nick was doing some other, like I said, Nick's kind of the director and the founder of Fargon, and he was doing some different video production stuff for a different media company, and essentially got reached out to via Instagram and was just like, hey, like we have this goat hunt that we're going on. It's going to be epic. We need somebody to film it. Would you be interested in kind of coming along? And he obviously went out, did that, and that's kind of like the basis, or I would say like the pillar that Fargon was founded on. So,
I've watched a bunch of your stuff. It's awesome. I just watched the mountain goat hunt and grizzly country one. That was pretty cool. It was exciting.
Yeah. That's a good one, man. That's a great one. So pretty epic stuff. So, even there, we did one with the first, like the Land of Legend, that I think was another pretty epic. All that high alpine, I think the goats and the sheeps and all that stuff. People love, and it's a lot of fun to film too. So
it's beautiful. I mean, you watch it, it's like, holy cow, it's just absolutely beautiful, you know. Just a stunning place. And like, are those over the counter tags, those good for you guys in BC? Like, is that how that works?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's definitely zones. It all depends on what zones you're hunting in. I'm not going to be giving anything to get away, but there is definitely over the counter stuff. There also is LEH stuff. So it really depends on kind of the zones that you're in and everything from there. So it's definitely a different system, at least from the States, like from my understanding. And every time I talk to dudes in the States, and to be honest, the state system like fascinates me in a lot of ways too, because it's like a point system, right?
It depends. Depends what
so
state.
So does it depend by state? Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah. So it's like some stuff has over the counter, some is a draw, some is random. You're drawn out of a hat. Some you build points. So it's all, that's what makes it so hard, is trying to figure out the differences and remembering the dates, because there are different parts of states that have different requirements. And so, you know, it's the federalist system that makes it a little bit complicated too, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So the way that it kind of works up here in British Columbia is that we have a lot of over the counter opportunities, which I think is amazing, especially for locals. Especially for us that like to fill our freezers, is kind of the main source of us eating meat, is obviously harvested stuff. But then there is a lot of like LEH opportunities, or limited entry hunting is what it's called.
Okay.
And that's essentially, I think, like a bit more of a lottery system where there's odds for whatever zone you're going to enter into. The money obviously goes back into the conservation of these species and everything like that too, which is kind of a cool way to give back in different ways too. But yeah, and then you essentially get picked like from there. And then if you are successful in your lottery draw, then you're heading out and doing that hunt, which is pretty cool. So,
yeah. And you guys have been out on some great hunts so far.
Yeah, man. Especially like this last year, we've had a couple pretty epic ones filming our project Subsistence, which has kind of been like a year long, film project that we've been working on that will be coming out, March 28th. So
sweet, that one, soon.
Yeah. Yeah. So that one will be a couple pretty epic one. Had a pretty epic doubleheader bull harvest or bull elk harvest. So that was a great one. And yeah, a lot of good stuff from there. So
yeah, that's sweet. I got to ask, like, I mean, you're doing all these epic hunts. You're from BC. Like, how do you get into filmmaking? How'd you find your way into this?
Yeah, like I would say my story is a little bit different than Nick's. Nick's obviously like kind of more on the director side. I'm more on the producer side of the business, and that's kind of how we make it work. Myself, I was actually first introduced into film through a need. I was working for a Christian nonprofit called Ride Nature out in Florida.
What's it called?
Ride Nature, RIDNATURE. And it's essentially like an action sports nonprofit organization.
Cool.
So I work for them and we did the series actually, which is the skate decks behind me, called To the Ends. And it was essentially out of a need that I came out and started producing and just made a bunch of connections through that series, that was kind of filmed all across the world. And then went into some, work for a media house and did that different stuff, worked on TV shows and different commercial projects all around the world. But to be honest, man, like the more and more, the bigger productions and stuff is fun and it's cool, but like the scaled down version that we get to do in the hunting and fishing world is just way more fulfilling. And it's like you can get into these way different spots and kind of let these stories tell themselves, or even if it is a commercial production, right? And so it's been kind of cool, really focusing on the hunting and on the fishing world, and especially personally as I've gotten more and more into hunting and fishing.
Yeah.
The filmmaking stuff just kind of comes hand in hand on kind of what you want to do with a career, right? So
yeah, it's so cool. So many stories to tell. That's, you know, that's definitely a passion of ours as well. It's like every time you go out, there's a great story that's probably, you know, hanging around in there 100%. Somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's worth telling other people, whether they hunt or not, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth knowing about for sure.
Big thanks to Vortex Optics for sponsoring this podcast as well. Most hunters know how important clear, reliable glass is in the woods. In fact, we don't hit the woods without some form of optics in our hands. Vortex Optics offers a wide range of high-quality binoculars and scopes and rangefinders, things that are perfect for hunting or bird watching or whatever you're doing outside. Their world-class products also come with an amazing warranty. I've actually used it, and it's really fast and easy to use. So whether you're spotting a big bear across a drainage or lining up that perfect shot, make sure you're doing it with Vortex Optics.
Yeah, and I think that's like almost like a line that we like to find ourselves in too, is kind of like on the story, like we want to tell stuff that we're passionate about at the end of the day. And yeah, we're not the most I don't know. I think there's a lot of media houses out there that are very like technologically advanced in the sense of like, even what you're talking about in the arch releases and stuff like this, like us shooting bows, like we came out with one video and everyone's like, yeah, like this was great, but you need to change all this form up and all this different stuff. We're not necessarily like about those things. We're not shooting like, we try to obviously get bigger, more mature animals. We're also not out there shooting like the biggest buck in the world or anything like that. But we're really like in it to like, what are the storytelling avenues that we can really pull out from this? And it doesn't always have to be about shooting the biggest, baddest buck or anything like that. But it's like, what about the one person who's been in this generational family in this hunt and they've been able to feed their family off of these deer for the last 75 years? Like those are the stories that like really interest me. And even if they're shooting a doe or whatever it is, right? It's like, hey, if it's a legal harvest and they're able to feed their family off of, and that's like the stuff that really interests us kind of as a company.
Yeah, that's sweet. No, it's fun to follow and you can tell. And I do like the approach of like, it doesn't need to be the biggest thing in the world, because anybody who's ever followed us knows like, we'll definitely, you know, shoot something that's not, you know, giant on occasion. Yeah. So I definitely can appreciate that. So you said you've got, so what was the name of the series coming out? Subsistence? Is that what you said?
Or Subsistence. Yes. Yeah, so it's going to be like a 45 minute film all about hunting and fishing and foraging. And, yeah, man, we're super stoked. We did have some funding from it, but to be honest, it's more of a passion project.
Cool.
And it's kind of just really hitting back on the values of two things. To be honest, first of all, I feel like there's a huge disconnect in regards to people and meat, like just as the general public. We think people think like oftentimes they think of a steak or they think of something like that, and they think of a vacuum sealed piece of meat on a styrofoam plate that you pick up in the grocery store. And for us, like we really feel strongly like, hey, like we want people to like get back. We think that there should be like a bit of a hardship regarding like every bite that you eat like of meat or anything like that. Like there should be a little bit of pain in it. And kind of like trying to get back to that a little bit. But then also like showcasing like the hardships and the joy that people can find in hunting and fishing. Yeah. And it's like, hey, like this is like such an experience. And we talk about the memories and all this different stuff. And like, these are like the lessons that we want to kind of pass on. So we ended up finding an individual, who goes by the name of Grizz, or his name's Justin Balzer. he's just like a guy that pretty much is weekend warrior style for the most part, works like 10 hours a day, doing stuff like with concrete and all this different stuff. But just kind of gets after it in every way, shape or form. And literally is like booking meetings kind of close to the river so he can quickly get like 20 minutes of fishing in, like in between things, or is trying to do whatever he can to kind of get out for the weekend to get out on a deer hunt or on a moose hunt or anything like that. So we essentially followed him throughout a full year, and have just showcased all the different harvests that he's kind of been able to get and why he chooses to provide for his family through this means. And for him, it really is like a family thing too. He's got his partner involved. They just had their first kid throughout us filming as well. And just talking about the different conservation values and everything like that that comes along with it, and trying to pass down those lessons on to the next generation too. So it's going to be a pretty epic film. There was, I don't even know how many harvests, everything from ducks to grouse, obviously, to a couple bull elk, to blacktail deer, to tons of fish species, and bunch more stuff too. So we're pretty excited for that film.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm excited to see those. You've done some, you did kind of like a subsistence style or like film with caribou hunting, didn't you do? Am I thinking of the right thing?
Yeah, that was Nick. That was one of his first things. That was before I was actually a part of Fargon.
Okay.
But that was actually for a lodge up in Northwest Territories, up in Canada.
Yeah, cool. So, that was cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it was kind of used as, I guess, like a bit of a bill as well to like being like, hey, like why this is an important means for hunting, and also really putting in like the conservation values of like, hey, like there is obviously hunters at the same time. Like we do so much for conservation, and I think a lot more than the average person would like to think or would like to see or whatever like that. And then a lot of that piece too was kind of like educating on the conservation side of things too, of these species, even though you are hunting them. Right. But
yeah, no, it's totally cool. It's fun to follow for. So what was the date you said the subsistence stuff comes out?
March 28th.
So. March 28th. Everybody check where can people find it?
It will be live to Fargon Films YouTube. So Fargon Films. Yeah.
Yeah, you guys are super excited for that. And,
hey, we appreciate it. So, yeah, we'll be doing a big marketing push kind of in the coming weeks, and hopeful for everyone to kind of see that film. So it'll be a doozy, as we like to say.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you coming on. Thanks everybody for listening. Keep your eyes peeled for this film that's coming out, and go check them out. Far Gone. Appreciate it, Nolan.